Hello and welcome to Trading Blows here for Neon Tommy. I'm Alejandro Madrid alongside Danny Savitsky, and let's get right into it with our first segment, A Jump Ball. And the question for this week, is USC basketball coach Kevin O'Neal on the hot seat? Now, I believe he is. O'Neal in two seasons is 27 and 23 here for USC. But the real stat to look at is on the road, USC is just 3-14 and 2-9 in conference play.
Yeah, I mean, you make a good point that USC's record hasn't lived up to the potential of USC fans, but it is just his second year. He's still getting adjusted, and you have to remember that his first season, you can almost consider it a lost year because USC wasn't playing for anything. And as we saw with the football team that year, you don't know what kind of effect that's going to have on the program.
Well, one thing when Kevin O'Neal was hired that was highlighted, he's responsible for getting people into the tournament in his second year on the job. And so this is his second year, and USC is not setting up well to get in the tournament.
Kevin O'Neal has shown some bright spots with his defense. And defense is something that wins games. We saw that with New Tennessee and Texas and almost with Kansas. Defense can win big games, but a lack of offense can also lose big games. And they lost to Ryder at home. Those are the chances you take with the schemes that O'Neal runs. I mean, you're going to have teams that play zone against USC, and they're going to struggle shooting the ball and trying to score. So I don't think that's something you can hold against him just yet. I think you have to give him a chance to rebound from the damage that Tim Floyd did. So, I mean, you could say that it's his specialty to get into postseason play 2 years after he arrives, but this is an unusual situation.
Well, you look at the defense, and they have been very good. They held Stanford to 20% shooting last Thursday night. But like you said, the offense has really struggled. His teams have never been able to solve a zone. You think that after two seasons, his squads would be able to find holes in a zone because zones leave openings, and yet his team has not been able to score well against those kinds of defenses.
Well, how about the development? Dante Smith was barely a rotation player, and now he's a major contributor. He had 8 threes in the game against Cal. So the shooting isn't there yet, and maybe it's his schemes, but USC, I don't know if they have the player talent just yet to compete.
Well, he recruited well in last year, but the thing is, he's got an abrasive personality. If you look at it, in one-plus seasons, already 3 players have transferred away from the program. He's known as a hothead, not necessarily a player's coach, and we've already seen that. He lost his top recruit from his 2010 class in Bryce Jones.
But an abrasive attitude is also something that can be effective in college. I mean, you look at a coach like John Calipari, but he's been effective. He can win games. Sometimes you just have to demand accountability from your players. I'm sure O'Neal demanded accountability from Bryce Jones, and that wasn't something that Bryce Jones was interested in. So maybe that's just the problem with Bryce Jones and not Kevin O'Neal.
Well, you look at it, you name those coaches. The difference between Kevin O'Neal and those coaches is that they've had a lot of success. Until O'Neal wins a Pac-10 title or two, he's got to calm down a little bit and not be so in your face if he's going to get things done, because players won't want to come here. We saw with Tim Floyd that you can win at USC. Tim Floyd made the tournament 3 seasons in a row here. He won 20 games 3 out of 4 times, and in his first year he was 17-12. So it is possible to win at USC. They have the beautiful Galen Center, and UCLA is slipping. So there is room for USC to jump up, and yet they're not taking advantage of it. Just 2-9 in Pac-10 play on the road, not getting it done.
You know, you mentioned the beautiful Galen Center, but it's not very beautiful unless there are fans to fill it up. And no one shows up to USC games. And you don't know how that can affect the players. And it shows in losses to Ryder at home that this isn't the ideal environment for a team to play in. And as for Calipari and some of these other coaches that have had more success, they're at much more prestigious programs. USC, it's not a basketball powerhouse. Tim Floyd got into the tournament with O.J. Mayo, who was one of the top players in the league. And we all know the implications of his recruitment, whether or not that was legitimate.
Well, the thing with the Galen Center is that USC fans will show up if you put a winner on the floor. You look at it against UCLA, sellout this season. So there is the interest there. If USC becomes a team that wins ball games, people will show up. Even at the Stanford game last Thursday, there was a sizable crowd. I know there are some empty sections. I see the face you're making. But yet, USC can fill the Galen Center if they want to. If they start winning, people will show up.
UCLA is a rivalry game. Of course people are going to show up. We could go 0-50 for the next 50 games, and people would still show up to the UCLA game.
Not in those numbers. 2009, my freshman year, the crowd, barely anybody showed up to the UCLA game. The student section wasn't even full on the lower level, whereas after wins this season against Tennessee, Texas, and taking Kansas to the wire, people showed up in force in a sellout. The student section over 3,000 for that game, whereas there was less than 1,000 in 2009 when they weren't doing as hot.
And with that, let's move on to Under the Radar. Segment where we highlight a player or team that is doing something that isn't getting the recognition it necessarily deserves. And today's topic is Monte Ellis of the Golden State Warriors.
Right up my alley as a Warriors fan, Monte Ellis deserves to be an All-Star. He would be the first person left off the All-Star squad to be a top three scorer in the NBA. How does that happen?
You mentioned that Ellis is a top three scorer, but really scoring is the only thing he does effectively in this league. He's not a great distributor, he doesn't play defense, and he's an injury risk. And even if you look at his scoring, he's not that efficient scoring. He scores in volume, no doubt, but he also plays 41 minutes a game, so he's got plenty of time out there on the floor to score. His true shooting percentage isn't that great. He's mediocre in points per possession. Is it really fair to call him an All-Star?
Oh, certainly. If you look at what he brings to the Warriors, like you said, he plays 41 minutes. He's their heart and soul. He can take almost anyone off of the dribble. And in the clutch, if I have to give the ball to one person, I'm giving it to Monte, because he can drive, cut to the basket, he can create the contact, or he can hit the fadeaway shot in the clutch. We saw that he did against Sacramento last Friday, and he's done it early on in the season.
Just to make this clear, you'd give him the ball over anyone else in the NBA?
No, on the Warriors.
Oh, okay.
On the Warriors.
All right.
No, there are certain guys in the NBA that perhaps, you know, I'm a homer, but I won't go out on a limb and say that Monte Ellis gets the ball 100% of the time on my team if I had to build a fantasy team.
Now, the problem with calling him an All-Star is that All-Star selections aren't an absolute evaluation of a player. It's a comparative evaluation. And when you look at some of the other guards in the West, it's pretty tough to get on that roster. I mean, you got Steve Nash, Chris Paul, Kobe Bryant, Russell Westbrook, Darren Williams, Manu Ginobili, Eric Gordon, Tony Parker. So does Monte Ellis really make that list?
Obviously he does. Look at him. Monte Ellis is in the top three in scoring. There's a reason that no one has ever achieved that feat and not made the All-Star team.
Yeah, it's because players who score that much also typically have another asset to their game, and Monte Ellis doesn't.
Monte Ellis has no one around him, trust me. You saw what the Warriors did against the Clippers without Monte on the floor. Steph Curry put on a nice show, but it's not enough because Monte wasn't able to help them out.
On a team with that many shooters, it's surprising that he doesn't pick up more assists. And they play at such a high pace. There are so many shots that he can be a distributor on that he's just not doing the job.
He distributes to Darrell Wright. I mean, who else do you trust? You're going to trust Vladimir Radmanovic?
Vladimir Radmanovic can shoot the three. You've also got David Lee, who's great in the pick and roll and pick and pop game. I mean, he's got the weapons there.
David Lee? David Lee?
Do you watch NBA basketball? David Lee's actually pretty good. I don't know.
I do, but he's not cutting it right now for the Warriors. He has the occasional big game, but he's not this quote-unquote all-star that the Warriors' ownership tried to pawn off as some great signing and trade.
Well, you also have to remember that he missed a sizable chunk of time with that elbow infection, so you got to give him some time to get back into the swing of things.
I mean, he's making $80 million total. He shouldn't take that long to get back into the swing of things.
Well, there has been some talk that within this backcourt that the Warriors have, that Stephen Curry and Monte Ellis, assuming that they had to trade one of them, which one would you say they had to trade?
I would trade Steph Curry today if I had to choose between one of them.
Why?
Monte Ellis, like we said, the ability to score, his clutch ability, and the way he cuts to the basket, he is so exciting to watch. I think part of it is you also have to factor in the fact that he brings fans to the arena. Watching him play is very exciting, and he's what makes the Warriors. Steph Curry, he's a pretty good player himself. He's young, he makes some mistakes passing the ball, but if you look at it, Monte Ellis is a very polished product, and I would not trade him.
Now, aren't you the same guy who was upset that Jeremy Lin was on this team because he wasn't a good player? Because he's a marketable player, and you just said that Monte Ellis brings fans to the games. Jeremy Lin can bring fans to the games. So I don't know if this is a really fair comparison here, because I understand that he's both a combination of excitement and talent, but Stephen Curry is a great player as well. He can shoot the ball with the best of them in the NBA. In fact, last year, John Hollinger did a statistical analysis of the top 10 best shooters in history, And if Stephen Curry had the attempts to qualify for that list, he would have been in the top 10 of shooters in history. And not to mention, he can also get to the rim. He can also pass the ball. And it's just his second year in the league. Plus, you got injury concerns with Monte Ellis. You know, his ankles are questionable. And you had that whole injury incident with the moped a few years ago. So
Steph Curry has questionable ankles. He's always rolling one left and right. You never know when he's going to play because he's always hurt.
But he does play, doesn't he?
Occasionally. I mean, he missed a lot of games early on in the season when he rolled his ankle. But Monte Ellis, came straight out of high school. He's a very polished product. If you can bring in a veteran guard to play with Monte Ellis, why would you not?
Why wouldn't you bring in a veteran guard to play with Stephen Curry?
Because Monte Ellis is a fan favorite. Steph Curry, you don't know that he's going to be a polished product. He's played very well.
He's already a polished product. He's only getting better.
Steph Curry is not the guy you build your franchise around. I think Monte Ellis is more of a guy you build your franchise around. He has that ability to score from the two position. I would rather take him.
There have been discussions with the impending or not impending trade of Carmelo Anthony over the last few months that he's a one-dimensional player and whether franchises would like to risk trading assets for someone who just scored. And the same question comes to mind when you think about Monte Ellis. In the same way that you can compare, that you can't compare rather, Carmelo Anthony to LeBron James, who does more things than just score, Curry does more than Monte Ellis. So do you really want to build around someone who scores in volume and not necessarily all that efficiently?
As we discussed before we came on this podcast, there seems to be sort of this irrational love from Warriors fans towards Monte Ellis, and that may be what's swaying me towards keeping Monte. Steph Curry's a good player, but something about Monte Ellis, he seems to be the face of the franchise, and I would absolutely hate to see him leave.
Something about him. Okay, I don't know if that's worth the kind of investment that he's going to cost when his deal expires.
He's talented. He scores all the time. He's so exciting to watch. I would much rather have him than Steph Curry.
Isn't his excitement a product of the system that Golden State runs? They have almost as many possessions a game as any team in the NBA. If they were playing a slower rate, I don't think you'd find Ellis as exciting as you do right now.
The way he cuts to the basket and the way he can go underneath, reverse, he can do anything near the hoop and create contact at the same time. Very exciting to watch. And now let's go to our final segment, the walk-off home run, where we rant and rave about someone who has really impressed us in the past week. And I would like to start with Blake Griffin. I saw him in person on Saturday. Unbelievable. Alley-oops left and right. And then he has the audacity to spot up for a 28-footer in the last minute of the game and knock down a three to bury the Warriors. Unbelievable.
Well, to be fair, Vinny Del Negro did call the play to get Blake Griffin that jump shot. He did what he was supposed to do there. That was the play. They were supposed to get that jump shot for him. But obviously, I agree with you. Blake Griffin is a fantastic player. He's putting up numbers in his rookie year that are basically unprecedented in this league every night. He's basically a shoe-in for a double-double on a game-to-game basis. He gets above the rim. He's on a different level athletically than any other player in this league. It's just absolutely absurd. When he starts to polish that jump shot and can complete his game, he's going to be one of the top players in the league easily.
Well, I saw it on Saturday. You look at Blake Griffin. He can cover so much space in such a quick amount of time that it's almost impossible to guard him. The Warriors had to double team him every time he touched the ball. And that way, the Clippers were able to get wide open threes all day. They attempted something like 30 in that game on Saturday, and if they had made more than 10%, they would have won the game.
I agree. His energy and skill on the court are incredible for a first-year player, but there are still some weaknesses to his game. Number one, he doesn't shoot free throws well. And as we've seen with players like Shaq and Dwight Howard, you can leave a lot of points at the line. And if he gets fouled in key situations, that could affect games for the Clippers. Number two, his left hand is not as effective as it should be just yet. He's a great finisher with his right hand, but his left hand is really not where it needs to be just yet. And third, he's an atrocious defender. It's hidden by the fact that DeAndre Jordan is also in the paint, who is a very good defender, although he does take risks blocking shots and helping on defense. But those are things he needs to improve on before he can put him in the top tier.
Well, you look at what he's done for the franchise. He's brought so much interest. People are filling up those seats. 6 sellouts this season. Looking back to last year, I went to a Clippers game and it was so quiet you could hear chains drop throughout the building, this time people on their feet cheering up and down, and it was a sellout. So he's put a lot of fans in the seats. Donald Sterling has to be pleased with that. Blake Griffin, certainly the consensus rookie of the year at this point with 22.8 points per game and 12.9 rebounds.
I agree. The effect that he's had on this Clippers franchise is absolutely astounding. And it is shown in their production on the court. They beat the Heat. They beat the Lakers. They're a pretty impressive team, and that is due almost entirely to the presence of Blake Griffin.
Would you agree with Clipper Daryl that Blake Griffin is the MVP?
Absolutely not. He's a great player, but he's not the MVP.
I would agree with you there, and that's probably the only time I'll ever agree with you from now on. This has been Trading Blows for Neon Tommy. Thanks for listening. We will see you next week.